I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. And we're back. We are bringing you our live show from the Hot Docs Podcast Festival in Toronto, where we spent an evening thinking about the question, what is Canadian food? So after talking with Maddie Matheson about his travels across the country, we were joined by Suresh Das, a food writer and tour guide to the unbelievable diversity of immigrant foods in the GTA, the Greater Toronto Area. Born in Colombo, Sri Lanka, Suresh moved to Canada at 12 and grew up in Scarborough, a suburb of Toronto, where a $10 play-all-day pool hall special led him to an encounter with a lamb roast in the parking lot of the Greek butcher next door. And that random cookout set him on a lifelong journey to find extraordinary foods in different communities and to give voice to the people behind them. He took us around his hometown the day before our show, and we ate. Armenian dumplings, Trinidadian chickpea sandwiches, Sri Lankan coconut relishes, Lebanese flatbreads, and more, if you can believe it. And so the day after that adventure, Suresh joined me and Maddie Matheson on stage.
Hi, Dylan.
What's up, buddy?
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The fact of the matter is I've spent most of my last 24 hours with you.
It's been delicious.
It's been, I feel like a vacuum cleaner.
I feel left out.
You got to join us next time.
It's been incredible. We've been here for 24 hours, and Suresh has taken us to, I think, 8 places to eat so far. Truly incredibly delicious food. And every one of these places is from a different immigrant community. So Toronto is absolutely one of the most diverse cities on the planet. So I want to ask you first a little bit about your method. How do you come to find the places that you loved? Do you have a system?
People want to know the system. It's pretty analog. It's pretty old school. So my goal is to see if I can talk about the stories that aren't being mentioned in media, right? So it's like I was comfortable growing up in a part of the city that's so sprawled out. You had to drive around to get from place to place. Transit's pretty bad in Toronto. So I grew up in these places where you spend a few minutes being somewhere you're uncomfortable because the signs in a different language and the people look different and they're talking really fast and food's flying out and there are no labels in front of the food. You don't know what things are. But in that space, if you just spend 10 seconds, your shoulders will start to relax and you get comfortable because you feel the rhythm. You get a sense of what people are doing. Maybe it's the bread that people are ordering, or maybe there's a dish behind the counter that you can't see that people are picking up because that happens to be a Sunday special and you're there on Sunday. So my method is really about how I can insert myself into those environments respectfully and learn as much as I can in that time. Mm. So it's literally like my technique is, a couple times a week, I'll see who's available in my circle, and we'll ideally, there's 3 of us, and we'll get in a car and we'll pick one neighborhood, one street, and then literally just zigzag as we go from place to place. Hmm.
But how do you know when the place is going to be? I mean, I guess you're not going to, I'm sure you don't bat 100, but do you have a sense of what will be delicious or what?
Yeah, usually it's friction. I'm looking for friction. I'm looking for not an easy encounter, because normally when you go to a place and the menu is laid out and you know what things are, you have a barometer, you have a radar that you build over years where you can tell that something is going to taste a certain way. But the friction I'm looking for is understanding what is so special about the place and maybe narrowing down to maybe 1, 2, or 3 dishes. Because I believe that no restaurant on the planet is known for everything great. And sometimes, in order to get to that end goal, I have to face some friction, because maybe the owner doesn't want to divulge that right away. There is a language barrier. Maybe it's busy and the communication is not in place. But sometimes if you just work through that friction and if you try to relay that you just want to eat, you just want to learn about their culture, doors will open. And when I do it that way, I bat really well. I've been doing this for a while now, so my radar is pretty good. But generally, it's the friction that leads to the delicious stuff.
Okay, so that's fascinating.
But like, can you put a little more specifically? Is it like you see something on a menu? You see, you know, the late great restaurant critic in Los Angeles, Jonathan Gold, used to have this joke. So LA, the Department of Health has this rating system of like, you know, if you pass your sanitation review, like with 100%, you get an A, a little bit less, you get a B, a little less, you get a C. And he used to this joke where like, oh, if you're going to a Chinese restaurant, then like the A restaurant is like bad Chinese food, the B restaurant is mediocre Chinese food, and the C restaurant is Chinese food for Chinese people, which is really funny, but it's also like, I love Jonathan Gold, I admire him, he's a hero, really also kind of racist. Like, oh, to be like good ethnic food has to be dirty. Like, so I feel like that's really problematic to think of it in those terms, but are there signs you look for? How do you determine there's going to be this productive friction? And then I'm gonna have a part B to this question, which is how do you engage that friction, like you said, respectfully and not just be colonial about it and show up and be like, hey, I'm here to get great food, give me your great food.
Yeah, well, I think generally I'm looking for places that have a condensed menu and I'm looking at who's eating there. I'm trying to find places that are corner stores in neighborhoods, right? These are not places that want to end up on top 10 lists or get Michelin stars. Mm-hmm. They're serving a purpose, and that purpose is essentially they're offering a conduit for nostalgia for a certain group of people. So you go to a neighborhood and you find a bakery, and this guy at the bakery is making bread a certain way that they used to do in some Greek island. And he's doing that because he's from that island, and maybe he's found the population around the store to be from that island. So everyone is just on high doses of nostalgia when they go in there. Mm. So you can tell when you go to a place multiple times, you can sense that. So this place is only known for this one particular type of bread. He doesn't care about media. He's not on Instagram. He doesn't have a website. He probably doesn't even have his hours listed on Google Maps. Those are usually good signs because they're just focusing on making the bread. And they don't have time for anything else. And usually if you see locals going in there, as in locals in the neighborhood, that's usually a really good sign as well. Mm-hmm. Inserting myself into it, I strike out way more than I succeed. So on average, if we say I go to 10 places, I'll strike out about 7 times. Because people either don't understand what it is that I'm trying to do, because I have a camera with me, and I want to be in the kitchen. I don't want to just, you know, take a photo of a dish and write 1,000 words. I need to get in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. There's a language barrier, so I'll say, you know, hi, I've been eating here for a while. Do you recognize me? And they'll be like, oh, yeah. You come here every Friday for the shawarma. And I'd be like, yes. By the way, I'm a food writer, and I have a column on CBC Metro Morning. And basically let them know that I'm here to highlight what they do. I'm not here to like try to steal their thunder. I want to be as respectful as possible, but I also understand that in some cases, I don't want to tell that story if the place is so tiny and they're doing maybe 3 types of soup and they have 4 stools and they only feed the immediate neighborhood. Because if I do tell that story, I will mess everything up.
Yeah. Maddie, in your travels, do you have this radar that Suresh talks about?
You're not as good as him, probably. You know, he's got the spidey sense, man.
We have apparently something under this table.
Our table?
Our table.
What is it?
Something delicious, hopefully.
Wow, good setup.
Suresh, you don't have to play coy. I know you brought this.
What is this thing?
So I wanted to bring something that Francis could, and Maddie as well, could
Me.
Try on stage. I think you should eat it first, and I'll explain what it is afterwards.
Looks like cotton
I
candy.
Want you to, yeah, it looks.
Looks like cotton candy, my dude.
It looks like cotton candy. So a big pluck, not a little pluck, a 3-finger pluck. Yeah.
Oh my god.
Wow. Okay. That's a lot. Maybe not as much, Francis. Maybe half of that.
Maybe not much.
This is what happens. This is what it sounds like when you kidnap Maddie Matheson.
I can't tell. Do you like it or are you?
It's beautiful. Holy cow. Like touching this, it feels like the softest.
Yeah.
So it doesn't break down.
Drink some water, Manny.
It's wild.
So it's like poshmak. It's like
Persian.
It's
like eating a cloud.
Mm, yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
depending on how much you put in your
beautiful.
Mouth.
It's amazing. It tastes like icing.
It tastes like nuts that have been somehow turned into cotton candy that is the texture of silk.
Yeah, it's essentially the Lebanese version of pashmak, which is candy floss, if you will.
Okay.
It's this is from Gadir, the place that we went to for lunch yesterday, the Lebanese butcher shop in Scarborough.
It's incredibly delicious. Mm-hmm. And actually, now that you mentioned Gadir, I'm glad you mentioned Gadir, because this is a place that Suresh took us to yesterday, where we got to meet the owner, Ali Dabouk, who is a lovely human, and we actually have a little clip of him, so you can hear him talk.
This is a traditional way. I remember my grandma, when, like, I'm telling you about like 45 years ago, let's say. I remember her, she used to do this.
Every day?
No, they used to do it, let's say, twice a week, because you want to do like for a couple of days, like for 2-3 days, then they do another for 2-3 days. So usually in the villages, they do this bread.
Are you able to tell me how old this technique is?
At least 100 years, at least, even more. Long time they used to do this bread, at least more than 100 years they used to do
it. So she's probably been making it her entire life.
Yeah. I'm sure she's making it for over like 40 years, 45 years, at least, yeah. Yeah, not everybody do. Like, even like, let's say if you're talking about my wife now, she don't know how to do it. New generation, they don't know how to do this. So you have to get somebody like old generation or somebody old to teach the new ones, which is...
Is it happening much?
Not too much, no.
That's actually a good point, because it took him a while to find the people to make this.
Yeah.
And this is a dying art.
You're right, yeah.
So what Ali was describing for us was a woman who works with him, a baker, was doing this technique to make saj bread. So the way the bread is baked, there's a dome, almost like it would look almost like if you inverted a wok and the flame was underneath, so the dome became very hot. She takes this flatbread dough, essentially, mm-hmm. and drapes it around each arm and keeps like waving it like a flag from arm to arm as it spreads and eventually becomes like the size of a, how can
large.
I describe this? I'm trying to say the size of a manhole cover, but that makes it sound disgusting. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to say, think of something that is manhole cover size, but really lovely and delicate.
Like a little throw rug.
Like a throw rug.
Like a nice knitted, ropey throw rug.
Like a beautiful throw rug. She places it on this dome. It immediately bubbles up and bakes almost instantly.
Yeah.
And
seconds.
This bread, as Ali described, is from Lebanon, where he's from. The tradition is hundreds of years old. It's, as I understand, this is one of the only places in the GTA that you can get this bread. And this is sort of that nostalgia that you were talking about, right? Mm-hmm. And the importance of restaurants and immigrant communities of being able to offer those communities taste from home. The other thing that's interesting about Gadir that you told me was to get there from where we are right now in downtown Toronto, it would be a 40-minute subway ride, after which you would take a 40-minute bus ride. And you said that's actually part of why the food there in that neighborhood is so good.
Yeah, I have to believe that the fact that we have probably the worst transit system in the world has somehow... allowed us to have these incredible food ecosystems that are kind of function like silos. Because the city is so sprawled, you have these micro pockets, and in those pockets you have concentrations of flavors and interesting culture. And it really feels to me, it looks to me that in some cases, these neighborhoods are completely oblivious to each other. They're just functioning independently on their own. There's a butcher shop, there's a baker, there's a convenience store, the shawarma shop that's been around for 28 years. And there is this ecosystem that has been allowed to thrive because there is separation from the next major artery or the next major city. Hmm. In Scarborough, for example, you can go from one major artery to another, and the facade and the low-slung plazas and the colors, the languages and signs and foods change drastically. These businesses, they function to serve the locals in the area. They function to serve that particular neighborhood. So the mom and dad that do amazing Malaysian food in one part of Scarborough, they open that shop there because there's a Malaysian community there. Mm-hmm. And now people will drive from all over the city to go there for that food, but their sole purpose was to feed the school and the people directly around them. And if they did a mediocre job, they'd be shut down because people would not go there. Mm-hmm. So that generally would mean the quality would be very high, because when nostalgia is in question, you're not going to settle for mediocrity, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's meet someone else that you got to introduce me to yesterday. Can we roll the clip of Odane Davidson?
I bake it, and that goes for like, let's call it 35 minutes. And then I take it out and then saute it. That will go for 10, 15. And then I steam it. So it's a lot of love is going into it. This is why I say it's the world famous Tata Jerk chicken, because we also make the marinade in-house as well. So you're not gonna get my chicken anyway, you know what I mean? Usually I get my smoke detector involved in the cooking. So if that screams a little bit, that's okay. All right. It's just telling me it's time to put some juices on the chicken. I gotta run with this, you know?
We did not edit that in. That really happened.
What? And then? That's what it means. See, I'm from Regent Park, you know, so I got ghetto love in my heart, you know?
How often does that go off?
Whenever the chicken is ready.
It's funny, that actually happened, and he grabbed the broom next to him, and then he turned it upside down and, like, just tapped it. Like, but he's been doing this for years now, so he knows
muscle memory.
The
drill. Yeah. So that is Odane Davidson from Tata's Hot Sauce Emporium. What you were listening to was him making his jerk chicken. Tell me about the generational difference, or if there's a generational shift in how these restaurants operate.
That's really interesting.
Who they're for.
I mean, in this case, with Tata's, Tata started because Odane's mom, Sharna, runs a hair salon, and she makes hot sauce on the side. And Odane said, okay, let's open a little place, and we'll sell your hot sauce, and maybe I'll make some jerk chicken sandwiches. And he sells beef patties. So, I mean, for me, like, I wish we had a camera and a Jamaican person in the audience, because that is totally not a traditional Jamaican thing to do. But to me, that is kind of emblematic of what modern Canadian cuisine is and the identity that we're kind of crafting. The identity of the Jamaican beef patty being probably the one cuisine that identifies Torontonians, because everyone has had a Jamaican beef patty. And
really?
Yeah, I mean,
this is incredible.
Yeah. So you go to these places over time, and you see that there's a relationship. Most of these businesses have a mom, father, hopefully, and a daughter and a son. And you see that there is, you know, some chemistry in terms of how they run the business together in most cases. And I've been going to these places for a while, so now I notice kind of, in some cases, the passing of the torch. And in some cases, those businesses disappear. So, for example, Gadir, he has four kids, and he doesn't really have any intention of letting them take over the business, because he's an immigrant, he came to Canada, he, you know, he worked his ass off to run this place, and he's at the restaurant every day for 14 hours a day. Why the hell would he let his kids take over that business when his dreams would be to get them to be successful and get an education and find something better? You know, I mean, my parents were very, very upset when I told them I was going into food writing. So in some of these cases, it's fragile. You'll go to places for 10, 15 years, and you see that in some cases, these places do close down. And then in very few instances, the kids will take over, and in very few instances there, they will preserve it the same way their parents would preserve it. Mm. In most cases, they try to break the wheel, and they try to do something different. And in a very few of those cases, it works out well. Mm-hmm. So,
well, thank you, Suresh and Maddie. Suresh Das is a weekly food columnist for CBC Radio's Metro Morning and regularly contributes to many publications. You can find out more about his food tours at SureshDas.com.